Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back. Day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's a delight to welcome Stuart McConey. Hello.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for asking me to do this.
Oh, thank you for coming on. How was your Get Back experience?
Well, yeah, it was, I think like a lot of people's, it was far more powerful than I imagined it to be. I mean, like all those Beatle nerds, I was very excited about it. But I didn't realise how emotional an experience I was going to find it. And I've talked to a lot of my chums about this, and they felt the same, that, I mean, it is not a rock documentary as such. But the, you know, I'm not really, although people might imagine I am, I'm not a rock documentary person, really. You know what I mean? I don't get excited about the thought of watching some documentary about, the making of Blood on the Tracks or whatever. But this is, maybe it's because the Beatles are different and they mean something different to us. But I didn't expect to find it, as I say, so emotional. I fell in love with them again. I know that, you know, you fall in love with them again. There's so much joy coming off it, I think, as well as sadness and tension sometimes and all those things. But all the things, I mean, one of my things I think about the Beatles, why I love them so much, I did a special of my show, The Freak Zone, that went for Christmas, in which I did lots of Beatles cover versions. And I said in the intro to that that it's a bigger story than just a pop music story in some ways. It's about, and Get Back is like this. It's about love, it's about class, it's about British history, it's about friendship, it's about sex, it's about politics, it's about humour. It's just a bigger narrative than just one pop group from Liverpool, isn't it? It begins to take things about your life, about getting older, about friends, about love at first, about the family, about background, things like that. Well, many reasons I don't trust people who, you know, say, oh, I don't really like the Beatles, which you hear less and less these days. Yeah. But it used to be a cool thing to, I think some people think it's a cool thing to say, don't they? Do you know what I mean? There's one leading light of the alt-folk scene, or semi-leading light, who I won't mention, but whose records always get pretty short shrift from me, because I once did a programme with him and he said, yeah, I don't really rate the Beatles. And I was like, well, you can get lost then, can't you, sunshine? What does that mean? It's a bit like purporting to like literature, I think, and saying you don't like Shakespeare. It's like, if in that huge, varied body of work, from When I'm 64 to Revolution number 9, you know, from the early rock and roll tracks to The Long and Winding Road, from, you know, in that scope of stuff, from the White Album to Hard Day's Night or whatever, if in all that rich body of stuff exploring so many different emotions and states in so many different ways and in so much different music, if there's not something that in there for you, I'm very suspicious of you. Ken Tyne is supposed to have said about Look Back in Anger, the play, I couldn't really love anyone who didn't love Look Back in Anger. And I feel exactly the same way about the Beatles, you know. So I wasn't expecting to find it so emotional. My dad was very ill during it as well. He's passed away now. It became a kind of nightly companion as well for me. You know what I mean? I binged it, like I guess we all did, in probably like two nights or something. But I've gone back now. You know, I found myself going back. I didn't really realise how emotional and life-affirming I thought it was, because none of us felt happier, did we, about the way Let It Be and the Beatles ended. You know, none of us really, like the NME's great line about the album, it's a cardboard tombstone. Yeah. I do get that, you know, that we all felt that gloomy film, which maybe not entirely, you know, anyone's fault particularly, Michael Lindsay-Hogg's fault or whatever, but because of the gloom of that film, literally, and the album, which feels, I don't know, somehow not right. I don't think we thought this beautiful story didn't end right. And this makes the story end the way it should have always ended. You know, we realised that John and Paul still loved each other, that they were still great mates. They were still making music together right to the end. That was a revelation to me, you know. I had this inaccurate idea. I know I'm digressing, but I had this slightly inaccurate image that by the time of Let It Be, the Beatles were four solo acts, essentially, who one or two of them might drop in on each other's record if they were lucky. They were a band. They were a band, and they were a gang, and they were mates right to the end. And that's so heartening to see.
Few people have mentioned it, and I think it's right. The timing of this, it couldn't really have come at any other... We're in an age of binge watching, and, you know, reality TV is, you know, we're used to that now. And also, I think during the, well, not the greatest days, it's just nice to spend some company, you know, spend some time.
Yeah, and that shared experience thing that's slightly gone as well. You know that that I found myself saying to my mates, "Oh, have you got to Billy Preston Day yet?
Yeah.
You know, have you got to the rooftop gig yet? Oh, you love this bit." And sharing and little, it's almost going to be one of those things. I think that I've already found myself using some of the expressions from it as that little catchphrase. You know, "Hey, I've had some wine. Remember Bob Wooler?" You know, I think I'm going to say that all the time now, and I've had too much to drink. You know, all those little phrases are fantastic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what's it? Yeah. It's just such a lovely shared experience. And I'm so delighted that so many people. Because I thought, is this just me who's finding this kind of quite teary? And I thought, no. Everyone is. Yeah.
So, as they say, it's been a long old journey, but we're here, day 21. It's Thursday the 30th of January, and it's the day of the rooftop concert. So we start, well, obviously on the roof at Savile Row, and Michael Lindsay-Hogg set up 10 cameras. So there's 5 on the roof, 1 on a building across the street, which it turns out he hasn't asked permission to put there.
Yes.
And 3 at street level, and 1, which I particularly love, hidden in the reception area. Which George Martin spots almost immediately.
George Martin spots immediately, but it looks impossible not to, because it looks like it's the size, it looks like a massive white box with a sort of pillar box style slit in it, doesn't it? So you can see George Martin thinking, what's that?
Yeah.
Yeah, but bless him, yeah.
Yeah. In the basement, we've got Glyn and George, and they can monitor it through CCTV, which seems very futuristic to me for 1969.
I know.
Sort of space age. But, while this is happening, the Beatles are still not sure whether they want to do it. They're having a meeting, but they do. So Paul arrives and he's the first to walk. And there's a moment when Paul appears on the rooftop. Like, oh, it's happening. And we're there in real time.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'm not really... You don't see all the... I've never seen... No one, I guess, has seen the stuff surrounding it before. So we're used to those pictures. We're used to bits of footage. Recontextualizing it like this, I mean, the bit where, like, he comes out on the roof, and then he jumps up and down on those decidedly dodgy looking boards to test it, doesn't he? And like you say, when you see the whole paraphernalia of how it's set up, I think, I mean, listening to the Peter, I hesitate to recommend any other Beatle podcast, obviously, etc. I know we, as a Beatle family, we're very generous of spirit, but there's something about the Beatles podcast who Peter Jackson did that interview with. I thought he was very gracious in this, and it made me think, Michael Lindsay-Hogg should be given more credit than he is. So, I mean, that's the setup's brilliant. As you say, he doesn't ask permission for the one across the road. The hidden camera, stroke of genius, though. I mean, because we'll probably come on to this, we get so much great stuff from that hidden camera.
Yeah.
But when they walk out onto the roof, I know that you see them, Paul's out first, isn't he? Ringo comes next with Maureen. Another thing about the whole of Get Back, but particularly... we're really the whole thing about that, and I think we've all fallen in love with this, is the not minor characters, that's insulting to them, but the sort of the supporting cast, shall we say, it's made heroes. We all loved the Beatles, we knew that, but who knew we were going to fall in love with Kevin the Roadie and Mal Evans, Debbie on reception, and Jimmy Clark, the mod doorman, who we'll come on to. And for me, another revelation was Maureen, the lovely Maureen Starkey, who, sadly, I didn't know this till I looked into it, who passed away only 48.
Yeah.
She died very young, surrounded by her family and Ringo. So clearly a beloved woman, and certainly beloved of George, maybe not the time for that now, but she was a revelation to me. She seems so cool, Liverpool 1960s, and she's she sort of got down there and she's quite shy about getting out there. But as they assemble out there on the roof, as I said, this lovely supporting cast, Kevin and Mal and George Martin, of course, is with Glyn Johns down in the basement. That's a brilliant relationship, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's so generous, I think, on both sides. But yet there are moments. I don't know about you, Chris, but most earlier on in the season, I'm thinking, oh, George, go and sort it out.
Yeah.
Which is so unfair on Glyn Johns, who is an esteemed rock producer. But it's so, but you just think, George says at one point, isn't he? I'll fix you, lads. I'll fix it, you know.
Yeah.
And he's so generous, I think, to Glyn. And it's such a lovely moment. When you see them both sort of sitting there getting ready with the tapes rolling, it's such a lovely moment. Of course, not that much of a revelation. How cool is George Martin? Oh. How cool is George Martin in Get Back? He's handsome, he's debonair, he's classy. I mean, he absolutely... I don't know if there's anyone sort of sexier in the whole thing than George. But yeah, but when but going back to you saying, they get out on the roof and you realise they're assembling, and there's quite a lot of people power. I was going to say manpower, that's a rather outdated phrase. There's quite a lot. It's labour intensive, isn't it? There's quite a lot of people out there.
Yeah,
that he's assembled to do it. And again, this shows the whole thing in a context that... we've only ever seen these sort of slight fragments before. And so I've also thought, the rooftop concert, it's all fun. But this sets it, you realise that it, also, we've seen all the stuff building up to this. Mm. We've seen Michael Lindsay Hogg's desperate attempts to get them to go to Tripoli. Which is, why does he want to go to Tripoli so badly?
He loves
but we've
it.
Seen that. I love it. And we've seen, like, the personalities emerge, which is, I think it's brilliant how Paul, ever enthusiastic. John, I've got to say this at this point. For better or worse, down the years, some of us have fallen into one of two camps because it's been presented as an either-or, and it shouldn't be, and this has changed that, I think. But I've always been Macca, and I've always resented the idea that John was the edgy one and the cool one, and Macca was the sort of vaudevillian, you know, patter merchant. Completely untrue, as we all know. But that down the years has, I think, made me a little bit jaded and suspicious of John because of his lobby. And I fell in love with John again because you see him in Get Back as a vulnerable, warm, funny person who clearly wants the best for the Beatles, which I love that. And, so you've seen all these backstories. You've seen George emerge as... brilliantly considering he's the spiritual one, as the petulant teenager, the breadhead... who's always going on about how much things will cost, which I loved. And how much is that going to... Well, you think they'll give us a... What? They'll pay for a ship? AMI won't even give us a free amp or something like that. Oh, no, he says a brilliant thing about... which has got so much class... not class war, but a brilliant analysis of the British class system in it when he says, yeah, they'll pay for Benjamin Britten to go to Paris, but not for us. And he's like, no, we're rock plebs, aren't we? Yeah. And then he says, Fender won't even give us a free amp. And all the time, how much is this going to cost? And just even the day before, when they're all going, going on the roof, George, the guy's like, I don't want to go on the roof. Yeah. So I did love how he emerges as a slightly petulant teenager. And that's presumably stuff about being the younger one, the overlooked one. That's been going on for years in that relationship, which is beautiful, really. Yeah. But with all the backstory, you see... The rooftop concert becomes much more emotional than it's ever been before. It looked a bit before, always to me, like it's just a bit of a stunt. But you realise it's not just a stunt. It's really, really important for them, and particularly for Paul, to have done something. I know it's not my day, it's an earlier day, but the moment when they give the idea, you can't hear the audio, but the moment when they whisper the idea to him, you see the smile creep across his face. Yeah. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's absolutely beautiful. So yes, seen in context, and so you get a palpable sense of expectation when you see them all emerging onto the roof. Yeah,
yeah. And again, we've spoke about it a lot on here. Michael Lindsay Hogg, his positioning, his plan of putting his cameras down at street level, I think is brilliant because you get a quick before they do anything, just a few bars of Get Back. And again, it's the great editing of Peter Jackson, but you just see the crowds, their initial, what the hell, what's that?
What's that?
Sort of looking up. Yeah. So immediately there's electricity and he's captured that.
Yeah, because, I mean, we live in a world today where that kind of thing happens a lot. We're used to sort of music and stuff going on in the street, aren't we? It would have been quite a...
Yeah.
It would have been quite a thing to hear a rock and roll group suddenly start playing, particularly on Savile Row, which for people who don't know, Savile Row's kind of a posh shopping bit of London. I mean, Savile Row is well known for being the place where you can spend £5,500 on a rubbish suit. I mean, a really well-made suit, but one that makes you look like Prince Charles, you know? So it's got that about it. So there's all the British class system is going on as well. If you notice, there's a lot of bowler-hatted guys moving about at street level.
Yes.
But the people who are on the roof who notice the Beatles look to be labourers and char ladies and stuff. You know, the kind of person who would get up on the roof, you know, as opposed to the sort of person who's in down there at ground level. It's like literally upstairs, downstairs, you know, is going on there. and I love that. But yes, you're right. Michael Lindsay Hogg really captures that sort of initial, when they break into that first... Yeah. Sort of run through of Get Back, isn't it? Where John slightly fudges the solo on the first time, I think, but he's freezing. You can tell he's blowing on his hands all the time. Yeah.
It must be bitter up there. So yes, yeah, so immediately after that, yeah, you get the first proper live performance. So it's the first proper live performance since 66. And yeah, all that rehearsal, they just sound so good. They all look a bit nervous as well, because when Billy does his first solo, they all sort of turn to him as like, come on, save us, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And he kind of does, because he's, I mean, it'll have been spoken about before in this series many times, but the brilliance that Billy Preston brings to the whole thing, again, as we talk about, I've mentioned calling them the supporting cast, he just, how he comes to England to be on the Lulu show and ends up joining the Beatles. Yeah. It's an amazing turn of events for Billy Preston. I should say that later on, I did think, well, maybe we'll save that for when the police arrive. We'll talk about that in a moment.
They're still unaware at the moment. They haven't had that's 30 right. phone yeah. calls in yeah. half an hour. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a great little starter. And it's good to see them. It's just kind of getting their confidence back. And there's a little yeah. ripple of applause at the end, which, because it sounds very much like a cricket match.
Oh, they're Ted Dexter.
Yeah.
Comment. What does he say? Oh, I think Ted Dexter scored another.
That's it, yeah.
No, and one thing I was going to say about Get Back, I realised as I was listening again, watching again that first performance, which, you know, they do it again better, but I've never really been massively keen on Get Back as a song, as a Beatles fan, because to me, it always sounded rather like a fairly conventional, I hate to say this, but meat and two potatoes rock song, you know what I mean? Meat and two veg rock song. So I've never been that mad on it, really, compared to some of, you know, the other stuff. You feel completely differently about it when you've seen it emerge from literally nothing. And just little things that you've realised that this is a thing that everybody must feel, particularly anybody who plays an instrument, but or you know, has been in a band. When you see Macca originally doing the early lines, and you want to say that's too long, that line, you've got to shorten that yeah. line, and you will almost willing it into life, the thing that you know will eventually happen. But also things like the way Ringo puts that fill in on the repetition, without getting too muso, you know, they get back, that offbeat, which isn't there at the beginning, and you realise really makes that chorus swing, because, of course, Ringo, massively underrated, but you little things like that, you've watched them blossom as the thing, so you sort of feel, it's rather like you know, seeing a toddler or a child that you've known from being a baby grow up. It's that same kind of sweet feeling. It's like, oh, I knew this song when it was nothing, when it was a twinkle in its dad's eye, you know what I mean? And now listen to it, it's really good. So it's also made me like, I will never, ever, ever, I don't think, really, really be able to say, hand on heart, that I like old Brian Shue. But having said, but it has made me like a lot of other things more. You know, it's made me like I, Me, Mine and Get Back a lot more, yeah.
Yeah. We got the first of the Vox Pops, which, again, this, what you're just saying, it reminds me of, because I remember reading in the reprints of the Beatles Monthly, just after Get Back came, and the fans' letters page, which is very much like Twitter in the 60s, it's great.
Is it?
But there's someone writing, that new single, Get Back, is rubbish, because, of course, the previous single had been Hey Jude. And they're saying, where's the imagination? Yeah. Where's all this creativity? It's just a simple rock song. So, again, and this is the thing I kind of picked up on the Vox Pops, because there's a couple of women, and the same question all the way through, really, isn't it? Do you like it? Do you know who it is? And they're saying, yeah, it's Beatles. You like it? Yeah, it's okay. And somebody else who was on before was saying the reaction, even when people say they like it, isn't just, yeah, it's the Beatles, I can't believe I'm here. It's just, yeah, it's good, yeah. Yeah, I like them.
Yeah.
And it's that perspective, you know, now they've grown into this huge legend. But at the time, it was just this odd thing happening by a huge band.
Thinking on the roof. This day's really interesting because it's the first day you get civilians, as it were, involved in it. Everyone else you've seen prior to this has been somehow involved in the operation of Twickenham or Apple or whatever. But this has got ordinary people in it, and it's such a brilliant snapshot of the British people in all their glory as well. I mean, you get those, you get those people who, but by and large, they're so positive. You get a slight feeling that they wish they'd got a bit more negativity out of people, as if they were hoping for a bit more edge.
Yeah.
you know, it's a bit of drama, a bit of, you know, you always need, but Michael Lindsay Hogg, I guess, being a filmmaker, you know about narrative, you know, want a bit of grit in the pearl that makes the oyster. Mm. And everyone's largely enthusiastic. There's a woman who says that it's woken her up. I don't want to say, what? Hang on, missus, is it lunchtime?
Yeah.
and then there's that other lady who says, right, it's nice to have something like this at the end of the day. And
yeah.
But there's the kids who sort of go, it's the Beatles, isn't it? It's great, isn't it? And but the hero of the Vox Pops, and we're being a bit out of song sequence, but the hero of the Vox Pops is the little old guy in the trilby who says, I think they're cracking. I think they're a lovely bunch of people. And he just, he's so marvellous. You can tell that in some ways, it's like... Yeah. The narrative should be that he says they're terrible and they're long-haired layabouts and they take drugs and they send back their MBEs. But he offered a crowd a lovely bunch.
Yeah.
And then, of course, quite rightly says, I wouldn't marry if my daughter married one. They've got money.
Yeah.
although, whatever the parlous state of Beatle finances was in 1969, I don't think it was great.
No.
But even so. But I love that guy. I love that guy for being so generous-spirited. I think they're a cracking bunch.
Yeah.
And then... You get all these dreary non-entities from Savaroga. Well, that's terrible for my... How is he bad for their business? But isn't that explained to me? They keep saying he's bad for business. Surely it was great for business. I bet if you're a little cafe, it was great for business, wouldn't it? You know what I mean? It seems ridiculous to me. And so apart from a little bit of sort of... there's a slight element of that. There's one or two sort of dissenting voices, but you just get the impression people are like... Yeah, it's the Beatles. Like, they're part of the fabric of British life almost. Yeah, we like them, it's the Beatles. But at this point, the relationship, one guy, you say, I don't like him anymore.
Yeah.
And that reflects that sort of attitude of, do you know that great story that the Queen, apparently on Boxing Day 67, when the royal family watched Magical Mystery Tour, and the Queen is supposed to have said, the Beatles have gone awfully weird these days, haven't they? I think there was, amongst some members of the public, wasn't there, that slight sort of, or couldn't they have stayed the lovable mop tops? We love them, but they've all gone a bit funny now with the haircuts and all that, you know what I mean, yeah. The long hair and the smoking dope. And I think, there was that slight, I used to like them, says that bloke, you know, presumably somebody who liked the early Star Club demos better than he liked Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields. But by and large, there seems to be such a great deal of affection for them, expressed so brilliantly from that unnamed man. I'm sad that that man, I don't think we get any credit for any of the Vox Pops, do we? Because I think that man's a sort of unsung. He embodies the best of Britain, I think, that old chap, who presumably looks like he might have maybe even fought in the Second World War. We're only talking 20 years afterwards, isn't he?
Yeah.
And he looks to be a dude in his 60s. So, I mean, that guy might have even fought in the Second World War. He's just marvellous. I love that man. I think they're a cracking bunch.
Yeah. And as you say, it's deliberately going out to look for some contention, I think, because they stop a vicar. And he's,
the vicar,
it's great. Yeah, it's not, you don't get much for free these days. And it's literally only a couple of people that don't like him like that. Well, I love the indignant old woman. She's my favourite.
Yeah, there's also a really brilliant one where there's two, I think, German tourists who they stop, but it moves very quickly to the woman, rather too quickly, because I'm sure the guy on the left is dressed in your full Bavarian gear. You know, you see a very short, you just briefly catch in what looks to me like a guy in one of those Bavarian, the hats with the feather in and the jacket and the lederhosen, and it moves off him too quickly. But I would have been tempted to stay on that guy for a little bit longer. But then she basically says something like, oh, it's the Beatles, we love them, So there's even a bit of, there's even a mildly international flavour to it.
So then we'd get another performance of Get Back, much tighter, and John's solo on this is just fantastic.
Great.
We haven't really talked about, well, we might do because I'm not recording these sequentially, but John's solo on Get Back is just amazing.
I didn't know, again, because I sort of wrongly assumed that the Beatles by now had become essentially solo artists with the occasional help of one of the others. I think I got that in my mind because what's that famous story about Paul saying, it got to the stage where I was too embarrassed to ask John if I could sing harmonies on one of the tracks or something. There's a famous story. But because of that, I really did think that they were more fragmentary, sorry, more divided than this lovely thing shows that they, in fact, aren't. That they're still a working band playing together live. I mean, I'd know, admittedly, that's slightly unusual, and that's because of that was the whole nature of this project. Let's play live again. Let's get together. But... But I just assumed, maybe wrongly, that they played mainly on their own songs, you know. So I didn't know that great solo in Get Back, that great lick that we hear, is John, you know. And and John invents that pretty much straight off, doesn't he? One of the first practices they do of it, he comes up with that. And it is great. And it is great. Again and again during this series, there's a revelations that, you know, watching John and George be so involved with Let It Be, the track Let It Be, which again, you almost think of as a Macca solo record because it's such a personal subject matter.
Mm.
And yet, no, they're right from the beginning working out the down, 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 down. They're coming up with ideas for that. So again, those are the really heartening things. Yeah, John absolutely nails it the second time on that Get Back solo, yeah. And he's sort of nods to his past, isn't it? Because I always get the impression John was, maybe wrongly, that he's more of the rock and roller than Paul. Having said that, I think Paul's pretty steeped in it as well with his Little Richard growls and screams and all that, isn't he? But anyway, it's a great performance, yeah.
It reminds me a bit of his, because he did the solo on You Can't Do That. And it's very similar because it's sort of all this, and then he does a bit of rhythm in it. So, I know what I mean.
Well, that would, I know what you mean too. And that would figure because, I mean, essentially he was, it's almost damning him with fair praise to say this, but essentially he was the rhythm guitarist in the Beatles, wasn't he? Mm. I mean, we don't use those designations anymore like people used to in the 60s, you know, but then you did have a rhythm guitarist, and definitely John was the rhythm guitarist in the Beatles. He was in many ways the engine room of it, standing there with his big acoustic guitar, you know, stock still a lot of time. But yeah, so he has got that feel. Keith Richards is the same kind of player. You often get little rhythmic things in Keith Richards playing as well. Yeah.
And I love the end because there's all these little ripples of applause. Cause there's only a few people, quite a few people actually, on the rooftop. And now we're starting to get people on other rooftops as well. But there's this sort of polite applause at the end, and John says, we've had a request from Daisy, Morris and Tommy. Which reminds me, the last time they played to that few people would have been sort of Hamburg. And they would be getting requests.
Hamburg or the Cavern, yeah.
Yeah, or something like that. And they would be getting requests. And it's all these little things. It's clearly reminding John of those days.
Of those days, yes, you're right. You're right, yeah.
And then we move on to Don't Let Me Down. And this is the take that appeared in the original Let It Be movie. And those three-part harmonies sound amazing.
Fabulous. Fabulous, again. No, Don't Let Me Down, such a great song. And again, you'd have to say on this one, this is definitely one where Billy Preston is absolutely crucial, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, Billy Preston makes this song. It's a good song, but it becomes a brilliant song because of Billy Preston. Because he adds a bona fide bit of soul, doesn't he? Which, you know, I'm not saying that the Beatles hadn't got soul, they did, but his playing is beautiful, and his really soulful electric piano playing is absolutely beautiful. And you can see why he's like a magical kind of glue in this thing when he came in, isn't it? It's just they all clearly love him. I love the bit, one of the earlier episodes where they're discussing, because that's what I thought, are we going to pay him?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
Is it Paul or is it George? He says, what are we going to do about paying him? Yeah. And it's like, we'll have to pay him. And I just love the idea that Billy, because Paul says to me at one point, isn't he, are you all right coming here every day? And he sort of says, yeah, because he's come to spend 2 days doing the Lulu show, hasn't he? And ends up staying, like 2 weeks, doesn't he? And joining the Beatles. And he must have.
Yeah.
You sort of get the impression you're going to ring home and say, look, I'm going to stay for a while because I appear to have joined the Beatles by accident. He's there, and particularly on this track, or particularly on Don't Let Me Down, he's so crucial to it being so brilliant. But he's tucked away near the door, isn't he?
Yeah. And again, this is another thing about the whole Get Back. Just the interactions between the different Beatles. So, because John fluffies that lyric on the last verse, flubble, and George looks over, he's got a huge grin at his face. But then it turns to Paul, and Paul's sort of staring at him a bit like a school teacher, and John's sort of looking into his eyes. Yeah. So the only way I can remember the next line is by looking into your eyes, and he gets it. I guess nobody ever really done me. And
yeah,
it's just that little moment between them.
The myth that's always grown up about Macca, you know, and this is partly because of the, I'll, you know, you tell me what you want me to play, and I'll do whatever to please you and all that, a bit from the fate, which is now, beautifully, now seen in context here, it's just a throwaway line that doesn't really mean that much, but it was so crucial in the Let It Be film, and it was the only bloody line anyone ever talked about. Here, you just realise it was one of the things that happened during a long period of trying to make a record that had good bits and bad bits, and happy times and tense times, and it's seen in context. You realise it's the sort of thing, it's the sort of thing people say all the time in working environments, which is what this is, and makes you remember that this is what this is. So Mac, this thing, slight thing about Mac has grown up, that he told people what to do and he was like the boss and he bossed them all around. I don't think it was that. It was just that in any group of people, there are always going to be some people who are the drive, the enthusiasts. Yeah. And that's Macca. He's the one who, oh, come on, guys, let's do this, let's do this. He's the enthusiast and they absolutely needed him. I mean, and the other thing I think is that they know that as well, and they defer, I think, quite naturally to Paul in some matters. There's a moment, I can't remember why, when Paul's out of the room earlier in it. The three of them are playing, and I'm trying to remember what song it is now. But Paul's not in the room. And somebody says, Ringo says, well, I don't know quite sure about this beat or whatever. And John says, oh, well, should we ask Paul about that when he comes back? Mm. They know that Paul is the most musical of them. And that's not a criticism they used to say that. Paul McCartney, I think, on the evidence of this documentary, might be the most musical human being who has ever lived. Yeah, I'm serious about that. And I put this on Twitter because Robert Popper, the comedian Robert Popper, said something the same on Twitter. And I said, that's exactly what I've been thinking. Has there ever been a more completely musical person? And what I mean by that is, as in, you get the impression you could give them any instrument and within 10 minutes they'd get a tune out of it. Mm. And you can give them any genre of music and they could produce something in that genre, from classical music to jazz to folk to rock to music concrete. And a few people on Twitter said to me, oh, no, surely not. What about Johann Sebastian Bach and Mozart? I love classical music. They're not as musical as Paul McCartney. Johann Sebastian Bach's music occupies quite a small field of stuff. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So does Mozart's. So does Beethoven's. They are masters of one quite small and very formulaic form. Paul McCartney, whether you think they're great or not, has written oratorio and music concrete. He's written vaudevillian pastiches and full-on heavy metal songs. Mm-hmm. I absolutely think you, to the best of my experience, I've never come across anyone more musical than Paul McCartney. And you realise that the Beatles knew that as well. The rest of the Beatles know it. That you can see that they sometimes think, right, Paul, what should we do here? You know, and I think that maybe rankled with them sometimes, as it would. Because they've been together since they were kids. People forget this. They've been together since they were kids, you know what I mean? The relationship in the Beatles is incredibly strong and deep and nuanced and rooted in stuff, you know. And that sometimes that expresses itself in joy and sadness and sometimes a bit in touchiness, you know.
Yeah, very much so. Right. We've reached the point. We get the arrival of PC Ray Dagg and PC Ray Shaler, who at this point, they don't seem sure which door to knock on.
And no.
They talk to a disgruntled old puffin in a bowler hat, moaning at them about the noise. And they knock on the front door just as I've Got a Feeling starts.
That's right.
This is one of those moments, back to, first of all, about the song, when that caption appears. This is the version that appears on the album Let It Be. Your heart skips.
You're actually seeing it happen. I know. There are a couple of times when that happens, when you hear one of the versions and you go, whoa, this is good. And then it says, this is the version they're being. You thought, yeah. This is so brilliant. First observations. Was every young policeman in London called Ray at this point? I tried to do a bit of thinking about this. But hang on, think how old they are. And if you didn't know this, be prepared now to sit down. Mm. Ray Dagg is 19.
Yeah.
Isn't that right? Ray Dagg is 19 at this point. He's younger than the Beatles when he comes to try and stop them. So, and I was trying to think, so weren't we talking sort of late 40s? Who must have been popular in the late 40s who was called Raymond, that people were calling their little lads Ray? You know, because it's Ray Dagg and Ray Shaler. I mean, I don't know what to say about this. It's such a lovely experience, Get Back, that I don't want to slag anybody off, but if it has got a villain, who apart from Alan Klein, but that's another story. The conversation between Glyn Johns and Lennon is so brilliant about Alan Klein in the previous one, about where you want to shout at the television, John, listen to what Glyn Johns is saying.
Yeah,
Glyn Johns gets him. No. And you know, when John's going, yeah, well, he seems all right to me. And yeah, Glyn Johns, don't you think he's a bit of a, like, odd man? You know, and all. Anyway, that's, I digress, and that's someone else's business earlier in the series. But you want to cast Ray Dagg as a sort of pantomime villainy because you think, man, you're 19. You've had 30 complaints. Chill out, man. You do. It does reinforce all your prejudices against PC plot, doesn't it? But you, and you think, oh, man, leave it. Chewing that chin strap like they do all the time. And I think, God, he's 19. I don't know. What is he thinking? And then I've watched it a couple of times since. And he's also a bit awkward and embarrassed, isn't he? Oh. Is there no way you could have done something else? And then his mate, PC Ray Shaler, I love the bit when he goes, well, I would have thought you could dub that on afterwards, wouldn't you?
That's it, yeah.
Oh, mate. So you're in this business, are you now?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, PC Plod knows all about making movies. I would have thought you could have dubbed that on afterwards, he says. Yeah. But it is great. But also, this is where the two more brilliant people, Mod Doorman Jimmy Clark, with his fantastic haircut and Crombie and tie, and Debbie the receptionist, where they do this fantastic, willful misrepresentation and deception, where they claim not to know what's going on, isn't it? And they claim not to know. I think they're recording something, and and it's all this. And I just love that, how they, in a very sweet natured way, they are obviously trying to hamper PC's Ray Dagg and Shaler's investigations, but do it in such a nice way. It's not aggressive, it's not combative. They're just absolutely trying to put them off the scent.
Yeah. And Debbie Wellham is a hero in this.
She's great, Debbie Wellham.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
What I love as well is Jimmy's got just such a smirk on his face when
Jimmy's loving this, isn't he?
Yeah.
And you see, this is another one of the things we didn't know about it, because the Let It Be movie, again, it might not have been anyone's fault. It's just the way it happened. And Peter Jackson's been very gracious about the film stock that Michael Lindsay Hogg had available and things like that. And so it literally didn't look very good. It looked dark. It looked dank. Yeah. But this is, we never would have, we were deprived of all this stuff. We were deprived of Jimmy, you know, and all these brilliant things that are now part of the whole Let It Be story, you know. Yeah. We wouldn't have known about him. And he's saying he's so great. I also love the dude who turns up wanting some money. Doesn't he say, haven't you got a cheque for me? And it's so staged. You think, is this something else to put the police off the scent? Because he's so beaming when he comes in. Yeah, have you got my cheque? And Debbie says, oh, haven't you had it yet? Or whatever. It sounds like a Whitehall farce, a couple of the moments downstairs. Yeah, yeah, brilliant.
And he literally laughs at the police because they say, do you know what's going on, mate? I don't know. And he literally laughs at them. Where's my money?
And I love the idea that, you know, well, we're trying to get them to stop, and they're sitting down saying, clearly no one's stopping.
No.
Oh, no, we'll get them to turn it down. And what does Mal come and say? He tries to bamboozle them with acoustics, doesn't he? He says, yeah, well, we could take the PA out and just have the speakers facing them, and you can see them nodding as if they've got a clue what he's talking about. Yeah.
Well, the worst one was where he says about, if I go down into the basement, I can make some adjustments there. What? That would have no impact on the music blasting out on the roof.
Yeah.
And they're quite happy
with
that.
He should have said, if I go down into the basement, I can do some things that will, whilst actually having no effect on the performance, mildly reassure you that something is being done. How about I do that?
Yeah.
The two younger policemen, then is it David, what's the third policeman called?
Oh, Sergeant David Kendrick.
Sergeant David Kendrick. No. He, when he appears, as a previous contributor to this show, Nadia Shireen has pointed out, looks exactly like the cartoon policeman in Yellow Submarine, which can't be based on him because Yellow Submarine's earlier.
Yeah.
But he looks exactly like him. But when he arrives, he's remarkable. He's a delight, isn't he?
Yeah.
I'm terribly sorry, but what seems to be going on here? Oh, the Beatles are playing. Like, are they really? I wonder if I could go up and take a look. And have I read this right? Maybe even in your notes, Chris, that he's 25?
Apparently 24, I heard.
No way!
I need to get that confirmed.
Well, but he is so wonderful. He's such a wonderful antidote. I'm terribly sorry, but do you think I could pop up? I know the Beatles and everything. Marvellous, marvellous. Love them myself. But could I just pop up and see what's going on?
Yeah. Because prior to that, we see him marching down the street, looking furious.
Marching down the street, yeah.
And
yes,
he's a delight. He's so sweet.
Yeah.
There's so much more. I think there's also the thing where Jimmy and he says to them, you know, there's basically saying, well, there's going to be some arrests. And he says, yeah, all right, hang on a sec. And he just wanders off and leads it, and they're just standing there. As I say, the constant chewing of the helmet strap.
Constant chewing. Yeah, we're going to have to make some arrests. We've had 30 complaints, which seems to me an awfully small amount of complaints. You know, but then again, as someone who sometimes works for the BBC, I know about these things. You know what I mean? When the BBC gets stung into action when two people don't like a programme, there's a certain amount of fearfulness about things. But I would have thought... Anyway, I wonder if those 30 people were. We should have them on some kind of Beatle blacklist, shouldn't we?
Well, he keeps repeating it. We've had 30 complaints. You can hear it down the station.
Bless him. I know, yeah. Yeah, but again, we wouldn't know about any of this but for the genius of Michael Lindsay Hogg's not very hidden camera.
So I've got a feeling we're back on the rooftop.
Yeah.
It's a lovely little moment where, as I've got a feeling ends, John leans over the edge of the rooftop, shouts, "Peace on Earth!"
Yeah.
And you see all of them go over and have a little peek.
Have a little peek.
I would have loved that to be in the original Let It Be, because that's...
Yes.
I always thought they were being aloof, and they were, right, they're not going to... We don't want to look at the fans downstairs.
That's right.
But they were.
That's right, And you realise with the shots from the camera at ground level that for a lot of the people in the street, they didn't know what was going on, did they? Because they can't see them.
Yeah.
So unless you were lucky enough to be working in one of those offices across the way, I mean, you could tell... I mean, one of the girls says, I think, when someone says, "Do you know who it is?" She goes, "Yeah, it's the Beatles," as if it couldn't be anyone else, could it? Yeah, it's the Beatles, which is interesting given it's entirely new material.
Well, yeah.
But they're just so recognisable, I suppose. The sound of Macca's voice and Lennon's voice is just so recognisable. But, they were hearing it, but not seeing it, a lot of people downstairs. So it is nice when he does that. You're right. It's a point of contact that was missing in Let It Be, the movie.
Mm. So next we get, One After 909.
One After 909.
Which is perfection. Yeah.
It's great, isn't it? One After 909, of course, is the song that Lennon writes when he's about 15, isn't it? And I loved how earlier... And it is great, this version of it. And I love how earlier in the series we've seen a mild bit of teasing between Paul and John about it when Paul says, "What's that bit about you've got the wrong look?" Yeah. Man said, "You've got the wrong location." And John sort of says, "Yeah, it's a stupid line. I think he's supposed to have gone to the wrong railway station." And they start laughing. And you realise it's because that's the sort of thing a 15-year-old boy would put in a song. It sounds right. It rhymes. Never mind that it doesn't make any sense. Why would he go to the wrong railway station? But it's lovely that. But it has a real energy to it, doesn't it, that version? Yeah.
Oh, wow. And one of the songs that really highlights George Harrison's guitar, because his solo on this is spectacular.
Yeah, it is. He's playing throughout is brilliant, George. This is what he always did in the Beatles. He doesn't do a great deal, but everything he does is great. And you realise that those little licks and those little fills and those little descending runs and are so crucial to the songs. Nice guitar as well, that sort of dark brown wood Telecaster he's playing in. Well, guitar, it's a good... it's a whole good documentary for gear fans as well, isn't it? From the beautiful Fender Rhodes that Billy's playing to that really nice big sort of semi-acoustic Epiphone that John plays a lot in. So, yeah, but no, George, absolutely, absolutely. You do realise again how they slightly take on the character and quality of myth, the Beatles, don't they? They become like mythic figures. And you realise, as well as that, they were, as everyone else says, a brilliant little band. You know, they were just... A couple of years ago, I did a thing on telly where we re-recorded, several musicians re-recorded Please Please Me in a day.
Oh, yeah.
Don't know if you remember that. We started like the Beatles did, sort of mid-morning, and we went until the evening, and we got various people, Graham Coxon, Ian Brody from the Lightning Seeds, your man from Simply Red, whose name's popped gone out of my head, loads of different people did different songs. It was an interesting day, it was an interesting project, and did it in real time like the Beatles did. And one of the sort of side things we did on that was I interviewed some people from the Liverpool scene at the time, people who'd been in like Rory Storm and various of those Merseybeat groups. And there was a moment when one of them, who shall be nameless because I've forgotten his name, but I wouldn't say it anyway, said, "The thing is, you see, Stu, Liverpool was full of bands. Liverpool was full of bands at the time. Everywhere you went in Liverpool, there was a great group. The Beatles, great, they got signed. But you know, any one of those bands could have been signed and been great because Liverpool was just full of music and it was great." Silence falls. And then one of the other guys said, "That's absolute rubbish, you know." And they all went, "You're completely wrong. The Beatles were way better than any of us." And I've forgotten who his name is now, but the first guy goes, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Sort of admits it. Because the other one's going, the Beatles were in a different league to the rest of us. And he's like, yeah, you're right. Yeah. And they were. And you realise this, that from time to time, there's a real chemistry about them as players, you know, honed over years and years of playing, mm-hmm. you know, in various, from the most salubrious venues in the world to the most rat-infested holes in the world. But they've been there. They've done it, yeah. Mm.
We've been through, you know, watching all of this film, as the whole world seems to have done by the sounds of it. We've seen all the tension and all the fights, but the best, and you really pick it up on this song, is the way John and Paul are sort of gazing at each other, and they're so happy. They're loving every moment of this. It's all been worth all that horrendous stuff that's been going on.
It's like, this is what we do, isn't it? It's like none of the rest matters. Yeah. This is what we were put on this earth to do, and it is, you know, in the case of Lennon McGarney, it absolutely is. I'm slightly obsessed with the Walton Village Fete picture. You know, I'm slightly obsessed with the whole thing that was around the Walton Village Fete. I'm obsessed with, I would love to find out more about who was there. Like, was there a drop scone stall? Was there a tombola? Because I'm obsessed with this idea that there were people there at that Walton Village Fete looking at the marrows in the prize marrow competition, buying a, you know, bag of chips or whatever, unaware that over there in that scout hut, the entire history of the world is going to be changed. That really gives me goose pimples to think about that. You know, there were people at that fete who didn't know that the entire history of the world had been changed by something that happened in this church fete in a bit of suburban Liverpool, which is amazing. And when you see Lennon and McCartney singing to each other's eyes like that, you think, you know, the relationship between these two guys, and Ringo and George, but particularly those two guys, those two little lads from working class Liverpool who, let's be honest about it, fell in love with each other, changed the history of the world. And it's goosebumps. It gives me goosebumps thinking about it now, you know.
It's amazing. It is. So next, we've got Dig a Pony, and John needs the
I
words.
Dig a Pygmy by Charles Haughtrey and the Deaf Aids. Yeah.
John could never remember the words. So they haven't got a music stand. Mal's headed downstairs to reception to speak to the two Rays. So we get Kevin, come here.
Kevin.
And he gets the job of kneeling down in front of them, holding the lyrics.
That's right, yeah, that's right. He kneels down holding the sort of clipboard, up A4 pad up, doesn't he? Yeah.
And again, Mal is chatting away to PC Dag.
Mal, I think Mal, if amongst the things we didn't know is I think the world, sadly, of course, we know that Mal's end was so tragic and not undignified, but just so not right, you know, for someone who's clearly so involved in the Beatles story. And I think in some ways this film is a sort of tribute to Mal. I think so many people have fallen in love with Mal Evans over this. You know, they realize how much the Beatles loved him, how much the Beatles relied on him. What a gentle, lovely presence he seems to be. The other thing I couldn't get on a more humorous note, Mal comes dressed as something different every day.
Yeah.
Mal, the first time we see him, he's in this incredible green suede fringed number that looks like Neil Young in the Buffalo Springfield. Then he starts wearing like hoodies and sweatshirts, and he's turned up for today's concert dressed like a geography supply teacher in a sort of corduroy jacket. And it's like Mal comes as something different every day, which is really weird.
Yeah, I find it particularly odd with him on the last day of Twickenham where they're packing up. He's got a suit.
Yeah.
What shall I wear pack up a load of drums?
Oh, I know, who does that? Remember, essentially, Mal was a roadie. I mean, he was more than that.
Oh,
but he was essentially Beatle roadie top man. We all know what roadies were. They have ponytails. They have those baggy shorts on with the pockets in the side and a mag light. Mal, I've never seen a roadie in a suit before. But I do love, and I know Mal's memoirs are going to come out, aren't they? And I think we're all looking forward to that, although we're looking forward to it with some trepidation, I think, about the latter years. But he does come over as such a... And you kind of get that... The Beatles were a pretty tight-knit little unit, weren't they? And it's when they start to look outside that tight little unit, like people like Alan Klein, that it goes wrong. I mean, I don't want to be one of those people who says, if it weren't for Alan Klein, we'd still have the Beatles and that would be great. Because, no, they were perfect. They should have stopped. It was a perfect thing to happen in that perfect time. Do any of us want the Beatles disco album from 1978. I don't think we do, you know what I mean? That's a trite thing to say, but you know what I mean? It was a perfect It was natural and right that that happened. But I mean, I do love the fact they were a tight little unit, and like the people they loved and trusted, like Mal and like Neil Aspinall and Kevin and people like that, and Brian. I think that's incredibly touching in one of the earlier episodes where you see them without any irony refer to him as Mr. Epstein. You know that?
Yeah. We've talked about that before. Why? And I've got a theory. Because they never called it. It was either Brian or Epi. They never called him that. I'm wondering if they did it knowing the cameras were on them. They wanted to make a point so it was crystal clear which Brian they were talking about. Not, if they said Brian, you know, people might not have realised. The fact they said Mr. Epstein, I wonder if it was deliberate. Right, make sure you're filming this. Because it's quite a statement to make. I don't know. But.
I see. No, you're right, because later on in an anthology, in another interview, they call him AP or they call him Brian. So, yes, I'd not thought about that. That's a very good point that they're trying to make the point. Maybe it's a point about being respectful as well. I mean, he's only been passed on a couple of years, hasn't he? And he was incredibly important to them, you know. But I did think that you get the sense of a real loyalty to these people, and quite rightly so. It's the most beautiful bit where you see that is think when Paul's writing Long and Winding Road and Mal starts chipping in with some ideas for lyrics, and you think, oh my God, man. It's like the terrible moment when James Corden starts singing all over McCartney in Carpool Karaoke, where you just want to get him by the scruff of the neck and go, have you thought for a minute about shutting up? That's Paul McCartney, you know. And poor old Mal, part of you wants to go, Mal, he's writing Long and Winding, you know, don't suggest anything. And Paul's so gracious, and he goes, oh, do you think so? Oh, maybe I'll put... And he sort of takes them on board. But you realise that that's how close they were, you know, to the Beatle family sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's only when they start getting involved with Magic Alex and Alan Klein that it all goes a bit weird, you know.
We're back in reception briefly.
Okay.
Mal has just promised them it'll turn the PA off. And
that's right.
I love that he just walks off and PC Shaler just goes to PC Dag. Charming, innit? And then Debbie Wellham, I love this moment. She really rubs salt into the wounds. While the two policemen are there, she calls Jimmy and says, Jimmy, have a sweet Afton. Which is an Irish brand of cigarette.
It's a cigarette, yeah.
And he's got such a big smirk on his face. Thank you, don't mind if I do.
I know, it's lovely, isn't it? Again, it's sort of dialogue you think should be written from like a Pinter play of the 60s, isn't it? It's so big. Have a sweet afternoon. Don't mind if I do. It could be from The Caretaker. It's so brilliant. Yeah. And clearly all of it is this merry dance that they are leading. Because you see in that moment, it is like, because again, to make this point again, PC Ray Dagg is 19. So he's probably about the same age as Jimmy, but two different Britons are there in that reception room, aren't they?
Yeah.
There's the hip Briton who, you know, there's Jimmy's Briton and there's PC Ray Dagg's Briton, and they're two different young Britons. It's brilliant, yeah.
It is just so wonderful. But it's here that they've actually realised that they're on the roof, because PC Dagg says, well, aren't the studios soundproofed? And Debbie said, no, they're actually on the roof.
They're on the roof.
And they're telling, you know, it's for a big feature film. And for him, you've got to feel for him now, because he knows he's being filmed. He knows they're filming a feature film. But he's got to do his job. He's got to try and make this stop. And no, he's just getting led down the garden path.
He is, yes.
But back on the roof, we've got I Dig a Pony. And which, again, the unedited version of this was used on the Let It Be album. And one thing I loved, which I've never quite understood, that bit at the beginning, with that, hold it. I'd never realised why that was. And it was basically, when they're doing the counting, Ringo's puffing on a ciggy.
And
he has to quickly bend down to put it. And that's
the reason. He has to put it down. Yeah, because one of the things you do realise from the whole thing is how the Beatles were essentially, you know, all the stuff about drugs, the Beatles were essentially fueled by tea and toast and fags, weren't they, it seems? The amount of tea and toast and cigs they get through is incredible, yeah.
So Dig a Pony ends, which is, again, an amazing performance. It's the one on the album. Such a great song. As that ends, John's hands, he says his hands are freezing.
That's
But I love the fact that Mal, at this point, has turned the PA down or off.
Yeah.
Michael Lindsay Hogg, he just sort of barges in, right, turn the PA back on. And it's weird because George then suggests to John, should we do Can You Dig It? Which was the jamming one.
Yeah.
Which I'm glad they didn't.
No, me too.
So then we get a brief impromptu God Save the Queen.
We do. The thing that became apparent to me watching the whole series, I don't know why they did. I don't know what the God Save the Queen thing is about, whether it's some kind of, they realise, I don't know. They wouldn't know at this point, would they, that PC's Ray Daggs and Shayla are downstairs, whether it's some kind of nod to authority. But what you do realise is that, I guess, every bit of music, I don't know if it's for PR purposes, PRS purposes, every bit of music that they play in this Get Back documentary gets a title, doesn't it? Gets a title and a composer credit. So you get these really weird moments where, do you remember there's a bit where George is playing drums on some rather shapeless jam that we now know the Beatles have a track called The King of the Castle of the Birds,
yeah,
or something like that. Because obviously someone's felt they've got to give everything a title. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So yeah, even these tiny fragments like this where they do a bit of God Save the Queen, which of course was an existing piece of music. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And next we go, I've Got a Feeling. It's not quite as tight as the previous version, but this lovely moment where John cocks up the lyrics again, and I love how his mind is immediately thinking, right, I need to make something up quick here. So it's, everybody had a hard year, everybody had a wet dream, so he's screwed up there, everybody saw the sunshine, everybody got obscene,
yeah.
So then before starting another take of Don't Let Me Down, they accidentally launch into Get Back, but it's,
yeah,
what I love, it's the exact moment of the opening crash of Don't Let Me Down. You get the two PCs appearing on the rooftop. So they've finally made it. And rather than confront them, the Beatles, they just carry on talking to Mal. And he's sort of peering around pretending to do stuff.
There's a lot of, from Debbie and Jimmy in reception to Mal upstairs, there's a lot of people pretending, isn't there? People pretending for the purposes of the police that they're doing something that will make this end, and just not just wandering around. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So then we get Back, and obviously, you know, everybody's been moaning at Mal, so he does actually switch off George's amp.
Yeah, he switches George's amp off, doesn't he?
And you can see him trying to explain to George, and George is, what? And and then he switches off John's. But I think also we need to mention when Paul first sees the policeman, his reaction.
This is a brilliant moment, the delight on Paul McCartney's face. I mean, what the delight might be, who knows what all of it's about. I'm sure that some of it is about, this is going to look brilliant. You know, this is, because you can tell from the conversations that there's a lovely conversation John and Paul have a couple of days before this, when you understand that, and I felt slightly on John's side here, unusually, that for Paul, making albums and being the best pop group in the world isn't enough anymore. That he wants them to do more things, be that theatre or films or big concert appearances. Whereas for John, making great albums in the best pop group in the world is enough. And there's part, and I can see that. There's part of you wants to say to Paul, I know you're bored because you've got such a restless imagination and such a curiosity and such a hunger to do things, but you are in the Beatles. Is that not enough? And I guess that's a bit, when Paul's delighted at seeing those police, I think, is partly Paul thinking, great, this is what I wanted this to be. I wanted it to be an event, and this is making it more than just a concert and an LP. This is making an event, and his delight is so. And he starts to, the way they all react is interesting. He starts to sing Get Back at them, doesn't he? As if to say, get off this roof. And George fixes them for the rest of the song with a really hard stare, doesn't he? John, I'm not quite sure what's going on with John and Ringo, but George really does fix them playing the guitar with a hard stir, as if to say, what do you think you're doing here, mate? Which is brilliant.
One amazing moment during Don't Let Me Down where Paul literally stares at PC Shayla for about 5 seconds, just staring at him with a kind of smirk on his face, and Shayla sort of puts his head down and looks away. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing because you see that they are in, it's like, there are lots of other places in society where we're very much in the police's areas of authority, but they have stepped into a place that is nothing to do with them. This is the world of the Beatles. Yeah. You've stepped into the Beatles' world and you're the interlopers, and what are you doing here, mate? You don't belong here. And it's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah. So back in reception, Debbie Wellham being brilliant again. There's another complaint, the guy who owns the building opposite. He's come out and he's genuinely befuddled about the camera. Who are all these people? I love her response is, oh, I don't know anything about that at all.
I know, that guy they've not asked. I mean, anybody who's made any kind of television or radio program will know these days the lengths that you've got to go to about risk assessments and permission and permits. And just there's something so brilliant about the fact Michael Lindsay Hogg just didn't bother asking them. Just thought a refusal will tie us up a bit. Let's just not bother asking the people who own this building. There's something fantastic about that. It's a more innocent and brilliant world, I think, you know. Because
yeah.
I just think the idea that the Beatles would say, yeah, did you ask? No, didn't bother asking, yeah. What's that old phrase? It's better to ask forgiveness than permission. And that clearly was Michael Lindsay Hogg's working dictum, yeah.
Yeah, all those cables all over the floor and cameramen right on the edge of
marvellous. But you don't realise that chap turns up, that befuddled-looking chap. You don't, you know, suddenly then you realise, oh, he's just not bothered asking.
And at the end of Get Back, you got the famous Paul ad-lib. You've been playing on the roof again. That's no good. You know your mummy doesn't like that. She gets angry. She's going to have you arrested.
That's right.
And then we get the even more famous John's, I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group. That's it.
Yes.
That line that we've been hearing for years. There he is. And we've seen it all come to that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
So you think it gets good. You know, can't get any better. And then they head to the basement to listen to the recordings. And it's just seeing all of them there, digging every second.
And they're buzzing, aren't they? You can say yeah, Maureen's loving it, yeah. that you can tell that they're buzzing. And, yeah, there's a where they pan along all the different shoes that are toes that are tapping. And when you realise that, of course, as well as everything else, Paul looks so great all the way through it, and the fashion faux pas he makes, I think, are those terrible brown shoes he's got on, which don't go with his outfit and look like something from a pantomime. And even he almost not quite as bad, nothing's going to be as bad as George's multicoloured furry boots, which I've had now that we're really in the deep dives about Get Back, well, me and my friends have had arguments about best and worst outfits worn, and I think George really does turn up in some quite shocking looking stuff, but they think it looks great, so I'll have to defer. But yeah, I didn't like Paul's shoes at this point, and he's looked so great all the way through. I think David Hepworth said recently, didn't know, Wood in Your Ears, because I'm saying about, is he the most musical human being he's ever, is Paul McCartney the best looking pop star there's ever been at this point in Get Back, which I'm sure there are some people who would go now, raised on a diet of, you know, Harry Styles, who would go, well, he just looks like an old bloke with a beard, but
yeah.
what do such people know? Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Talking about outfits, you'll be pleased to know that Nadia Shireen's dressed up as Glyn Johns for the X-Pod episode.
I've already had a sneak preview of that. Yeah, of that Glyn Johns. Yeah, because Glyn Johns is another one. I grew to like Glyn, but in the first few, he said, you know, like Glyn Kurzweil. But in the first bits, I started thinking, hang on, he's trying to upstage the band with his clothes, like one of those people you think you're cooler than the band. But I don't think it was. I think it was just, it was the 60s, man, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the bit where you first see, it's brilliant, when you first see Alan Parsons. Now, I'm used to thinking of Alan Parsons, when I think of Alan Parsons, I think of the slightly bouffanted, BG-looking guy with the beard who was in Alan Parsons Project sleeves in the 70s and 80s. And you see him in this, and he's a young lad. He must only be in his teens, I guess. And he looks like he looks like a member of the Verve. You know, doesn't he? Yeah. He looks like a really pale, interesting sort of indie kid. And also, you think as well, wow, when you think of what I was getting up to as a teenager, Alan Parsons was tape popping the Beatles and then recording Dark Side of the Moon.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's incredible, you know.
But I think it ends so lovely on there. And you've got all the little interaction. You've got Maureen and Linda smiling at each other.
That's right.
There's a lovely little moment where John is messing around with his zip on his top. And Yoko sort of leans over and zips it back up and gives
him
a real stern sort of mother look.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then obviously the bit where Paul and Linda are holding hands and then Ringo puts his hand
on. Oh, Ringo puts his hand on. That's gorgeous, isn't it? It's a gorgeous moment, yeah.
Just silly little moments like that. And I'm so glad that it didn't happen, because Paul suggests that they have lunch and then they should record the others, which I think would have been... And it was just the fact that they couldn't get all the equipment down in time that they didn't. But I think it would have been a...
I agree. The moment is there, isn't it? It was... It's. Yeah, I agree with you. You wouldn't want a whole load of extra stuff that's not, that adds nothing to that perfection of that moment, really. And but as you said, those moments like when they're clearly buzzing and George says something about maybe we should all play on different roofs of different buildings or something like yeah. that, they're clearly really thrilled about what they've done, because of course what they have done is reconnected with the thing that they were brilliant at and did for years, haven't you? I mean, is it 3 years at this point would have been since they've ever played together in front yeah. of an audience. Yeah, yeah. And you can just tell, it's like, this is why we started doing this. You know, this is why, this is what all this was before the Indian mysticism and before the Baggins for Peace, which I know it's not quite yet, but before any of that, before the bigger than Christ hostilities and all that sort of stuff, what we started doing this whole thing because we were four lads who played brilliantly together in little rooms. And they've reconnected with that, you know, and it's charming. I know it becomes much. I don't want to be reductive, because I always hate it when people say, like, it's like when people say, I have some brilliant orchestral pop song. Oh, you just need to strip it back to an acoustic guitar, man, to see if it's any good. I don't agree with any of that. I don't agree with. But I do think that in this case, they have been playing together in little rooms together since 1962 or whatever. And they've reconnected with that, and you can see they're all slightly buzzing. And I'm so pleased that that's the last thing, these are the last things you see. And it's like, so we didn't get the full story with Let It Be. Whoever's fault it was, or no one's fault. But that slightly sour taste in the mouth that we've always had about, it's like we've got Peter Jackson, somehow he's given us back the Beatles and he's finished the story the way we always wanted it to happen, which is really, it is powerfully emotional. I did not expect the whole thing to be as emotional a roller coaster as it is.
It is indeed. Stuart McConey, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. Hey!